Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS FM 89.5 in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, it's a rarity for a movie, a big budget Hollywood movie, one by Steven Spielberg yet, to deal with constitutional law, to be focused on the process leading up to a constitutional amendment. And so I'm really hesitant to do anything that can be seen as the least bit critical of the movie Lincoln, which has been nominated for an Oscar in 2012. And, you know, it's I feel almost small-minded saying anything that's the least bit negative about it. But quite honestly, after I saw the movie and after I talked to some of my colleagues about it, I began to wonder. It's a great movie, but is it accurate? It tells a wonderful story, but is the story true? So I went to my go-to guy on Civil War matters. I called up my old buddy Paul Finkelman. Paul's been on the show a couple of times. He's a specialist in American legal history, constitutional law, race, and the law. He's authored 150-plus articles. He's written in the New York Times and lots of other important places. And he helped us out on our episode on the Emancipation Proclamation and on other ones as well. So I spoke to Paul, and I basically said, Paul, is this movie accurate? And he answered me. But I'm not going to tell you what he said, because Paul tells it so much better than I do. So let's talk about Lincoln, fact or fiction, and let's let Professor Paul Finkelman give us the answer.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here.
It is a delight to have you always. You've done such a great job when we've interviewed you about Lincoln before, actually. We talked once before about the Emancipation Proclamation.
Right.
And that was a fascinating episode, and it's been much in the news lately with the 150th anniversary of it so recently. But now we're going to talk about something else that's a little bit more in the popular consciousness, and that is the movie Lincoln. Have you seen it?
I have seen it.
What did you think about it?
It's a great movie. It's a wonderful entertainment.
I think I know where you're going with this. It's a wonderful entertainment. That's going to be our focus. Was it accurate?
Well, no, but, you know, it depends. It depends how you, what you mean by accurate. There was nothing in it that was factually, grotesquely inaccurate, except for the plot of the movie.
There was nothing grotesquely inaccurate except for the plot. Okay, yeah. I think we'll need a little explanation.
Well, what I mean by that is, it's not like you have a movie where you create a false mistress for Abraham Lincoln, right, or you create some character that doesn't exist who's a major player in the movie. If, for example, if you think about the movie Glory,
right,
which was also, I think, was a Steven Spielberg movie.
It might have been.
Mm-hmm. Or better yet, I'll use a different name. If you think about the movie The Amistad, which is a Steven Spielberg movie, he creates a character in there, a Roman Catholic federal judge who never existed, and he has all of this religious nonsense about the judge coming to conclusions, which is all fantasy.
He
creates a meeting where the guy who led the Amistad Revolt, Sing K, sits down with John Quincy Adams and debates the finer points of law. Sing K didn't really speak English. That would have been a very difficult conversation.
And there was nothing like that in this one.
And there was no evidence that John Quincy Adams ever met Sing K anyways. And then at the end of the movie, the Supreme Court has like a court hearing, and the verdict of the court is the Amistad's go free. Well, that's, we know. That's not how the Supreme Court does it. It gives an opinion. Nobody's in the room. John Quincy Adams isn't standing there, sitting there waiting for the court opinion to come down. So it's kind of all fantasy, nonsense, stupidity. There's nothing like that in the movie.
In Lincoln.
In Lincoln.
Okay. I did notice there were no vampires, and I was pleased about that.
There were no vampires. I have not seen the movie about the vampires, so I can't comment.
You need to see that movie. Yes, you do. But that's a different subject.
Yeah. Some of the movie does a fabulous job of portraying accurately both the sense of the times and the horror of the Civil War. There's the scene where Lincoln's son is at the hospital. Lincoln is visiting soldiers, and a couple of soldiers come by with a cart that is dripping blood, and what they end up doing is dumping amputated arms and legs into a pit.
That was a striking scene.
And that was a scene that tells us a great deal about the Civil War. Now, the only thing wrong with that scene probably is it wouldn't have been at a hospital. It would have been in a field hospital right after a battle. Mm-hmm. But the standard operating procedure, and I don't mean to make a pun with operating,
right,
but the standard medical procedure in much of the war is simply you chop it off. And so hands and feet and legs and arms are being amputated all the time without anesthetics. And no anesthesia, maybe liquor, tie people down.
You know, you mentioned that, Paul, and that actually was kind of surprising to me when Lincoln announced he was going to a hospital to visit some of the wounded. I anticipated a bit more gruesomeness in the hospital and a bit more agony being portrayed, and there wasn't really that. It was understated. You saw the amputees, and then you saw their limbs going into the pit. You saw the dripping blood, but I don't recall any scenes where they actually had people screaming in agony as their limbs were being cut off.
Right, and that would have, in fact, more likely have been in the battlefield hospital than it would have been in the hospital. What Lincoln is visiting is the hospital where the soldiers from the field are recuperating from their wounds. So it is not the horror of military operations where the doctor is sawing off bones. But nevertheless, that scene certainly gives the average viewer a sense of the incredible horror of the Civil War. One of the things that it's hard for Americans to wrap their heads around is just how brutal and devastating the Civil War was. We read in the history books that the war killed 625,000 to 650,000 Americans. Those are the general ballpark figures. And that's including both Confederate soldiers and United States Army soldiers. So that if you, because the theory is that they're all Americans.
Right.
And the next thing you read is that more Americans died in the Civil War than any other war. Well, of course, that's because Americans are on both sides of the war. And that more Americans died in the Civil War than in all our other wars combined, which is true. But what this doesn't tell you is just what this meant for the Civil War generation. So let me give you a figure. In 1860, the United States has a population of about 30 million people, 30 to 31 million people. In 2010, the United States has a population of about 300 million. So if you lost 650,000 Americans in the Civil War, that would be the equivalent of a war today where we lose 6.5 million Americans.
Wow.
And so when we think about the Civil War, it's not merely the total number, but as an impact on the society, think of the hundreds of thousands of widows or women who will never marry because their potential husband is buried somewhere between Gettysburg and Vicksburg.
Right.
Think of the hundreds of thousands of children who won't see their brothers or their fathers. It is a devastating war. It is a shocking war in terms of the numbers of casualties. And that doesn't include, of course, what the scene we were just talking about shows, which is all of the amputees, all of the people who come back with devastating wounds. It is a searing event in American history.
And many of those guys are going to be living for decades and decades without their legs, without their arms. There's going to be evidence of that, and there's going to be repercussions of that for decades.
For decades. And there are some scholars who say what we really should do is recalculate Civil War deaths based on people who died from their wounds. But I'm not sure I'm overly sympathetic to that analysis, only because if you're wounded in the war and you die 30 years later from something that the wound caused, is that really a Civil War death?
It's hard to calculate as well.
Yeah, it's very hard to calculate. But if you just use the numbers we have, 625 to 650,000, it is a huge loss. So the movie conveys that. There are a few post-battlefield scenes. You don't see the battle raging.
Right.
You see people, and the dead are everywhere, which they are.
That was very striking, too. I think he was going through Petersburg at the end. He was riding on his way to Richmond. Yeah. And it was covered. The ground was covered with corpses. It wasn't just one every 15 or 20 feet. They were on top of one another.
There were battles like that.
What was the fellow's name, Brady, who took this picture?
Now, we should also, I was going to say, one of the things we also need to know, which most Americans don't, is that these fabulous pictures we have, done mostly by Matthew Brady, many of them are staged. So in the battlefield, Brady would move bodies around to get the right angle, to get the right pile of bodies, etc. But there are moments when, in fact, the bodies are literally piled up. There is the famous scene and event at the Battle of Antietam where Robert E. Lee, in what is a monumentally stupid tactical decision, puts his soldiers in what's known as a sunken road, which is a road that goes about 4 or 5 feet down with cornfields on either side of it.
It's still there, by the way.
It's still there.
Yeah, you can go see it.
And he has his soldiers standing in the sunken road and so they can stand up and put their rifles on the ground above the sunken road and shoot at U.S. Army soldiers that are coming through a cornfield. The first two waves of U.S. Army soldiers are devastated by this rifle fire. The U.S. Army at that point stops trying to go through the cornfield and instead goes to either side of the sunken road and fires down into the sunken road. And Lee, of course, in ordering the troops into the sunken road, makes the two biggest mistakes that you would ever make in military battlefield tactics. He gave up the high ground and he didn't guard his flanks.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the battle, you can literally walk across the road by not going down into the trench, because so many dead Confederates there, you can just walk across the Confederate bodies.
Wow. So one thing that Lincoln, the movie, gets correct is, if not in the details, in the macro sense, is portrayal of the brutality and the difficulty of the war, the terrible wounds that were inflicted, the terrible violence that was inflicted. But, of course, most of the movie is about politics.
That's right.
And so, lest I forget to ask this question, let me just say that it seemed to me that the central dramatic tension that was set up in the movie was the idea that, on the one hand, there were peace overtures coming from the Confederacy, which was on its knees at this point. It's in 1865. And a concern on Lincoln's part that if he didn't get the 13th Amendment, at least out of Congress, before any such surrender came about, or even before any serious peace overtures became public knowledge, that there would be a failure of motivation, that he would lose the ability to pass that amendment out of Congress, even though the next Congress was going to be more Republican than the one that existed at the time. Is that central tension accurate? Is that a correct political circumstance?
I think it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of things we need to understand. The congressional elections take place in November. And
1864.
But the new Congress normally doesn't meet until the following December, which means you would be elected in November 1864. The new Congress would normally come into session in December 1865. So there's essentially 13 months between the congressional election and the new Congress being seated. Meanwhile, of course, the president gets inaugurated in March in those days.
Mm-hmm.
No, not in January like today. And the president would govern without the new Congress. And the old Congress, the lame duck Congress, is actually meeting in December and January.
Of 1865.
Okay. So it's December 64, January 65. So the outgoing Congress had been meeting in special session the previous summer. They had met in 64. And the outgoing Senate had overwhelmingly passed the constitutional amendment. Remember, it takes two-thirds of each house to pass a constitutional amendment to send it on to the states for ratification.
And then three-quarters of the states,
right. That's right. Senate overwhelmingly passed the 13th Amendment. The House voted it down twice because while there's a majority in favor of emancipation, you don't have a two-thirds majority.
And that was made up of mostly Republicans. Certainly the radical Republicans.
It's made up of all the Republicans.
Okay, well, let's just discuss the various factions. You've got the Republicans and the Democrats facing off. The Republicans are the party of Lincoln at this point. They're the abolitionist party, or they have more abolitionists in them. You've got the radical Republicans, led by Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania, and they're very pro-abolition. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the more conservative wing.
Right.
Okay, and that, no, I'll let you, you can explain.
Well, but the point is that on emancipation, there's no difference. And this is one of the phoninesses.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you. They had the conservative wing of the Republican Party as being not kind of lukewarm on emancipation.
Where
the Democrats were the anti-emancipation party.
There's nobody in the Republican Party in 1864 that is opposed to emancipation.
Really? Okay, then that was completely inaccurate because they had Blair up there of Blair House fame and all of that.
And again, there's nobody in Lincoln's cabinet who's opposed to emancipation. Let's back up to 1862.
Okay.
Spring of 1862, with a Republican majority in both houses, Congress abolishes slavery in the District of Columbia. This is the first time under the U.S. Constitution that this Congress has ended slavery in a place where Congress has power to do so, and it does it immediately. It's not gradual. It's not in the future. It's not the children of slaves will be born free. It's all the slaves in the District of Columbia are now free, and those masters who had slaves in the District of Columbia as of a certain date are entitled to compensation, and they get $300 each for their slaves because you can't take private property without compensation. But many masters who were in D.C. who weren't there by the set date, they don't get compensation. They just lose their slaves. A few weeks later, Congress passes a law abolishing slavery immediately in the federal territories, sort of overruling the Dred Scott decision. Mm-hmm. No compensation. They've just gotten rid of slavery. That summer, Congress passes the Second Confiscation Act, which provides a legal process to take slaves away from rebel masters, which is now anybody in the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, this Congress makes it a crime, not just a violation of the rules, but a crime for a U.S. Army officer to return a fugitive slave to anybody, including a loyal master in, say, Kentucky or Missouri.
That is extraordinary.
So what you've got is a Republican Congress that is moving against slavery everywhere that it can. Had there been no Emancipation Proclamation, had there been no 13th Amendment, the Second Confiscation Act could have led to the emancipation of most slaves, although it would have been difficult. Mm-hmm. It would have been complicated. It would have been cumbersome. In the Militia Act passed in the summer of 1862, Congress authorizes the president to enlist anyone to fight to end the war, to win the war. Anyone means free blacks.
Right.
In August 62, before the Emancipation Proclamation is issued, Lincoln authorizes the enlistment of black soldiers on the Sea Islands off the coast of South Carolina. So that by the time Lincoln issues the preliminary proclamation in September, you already have black troops training in blue uniforms to be soldiers. They are enlisted. They are going through what would today we would call basic training. In Lincoln's cabinet, in late July, proposes the Emancipation Proclamation to the cabinet.
July of 62.
Mm-hmm. Everybody in the cabinet, including Montgomery Blair, is in favor of the Emancipation Proclamation. The only debate in the cabinet is when to issue it. Everybody in the cabinet except Blair, says issue it now or issue it as soon as we have a big military victory because we don't want to appear weak. We want to issue it out of strength, not weakness. Blair says, wait till the November elections because we'll get clobbered in the elections. He's right. The Republicans are going to lose a lot of seats. Now you fast forward to December 1864, mm-hmm. or January 1865. Blair is not less in favor.
Yeah, okay. Well, then that's probably the central inaccuracy, at least that we've discovered so far, is that there really was not that tension within the Republican Party, is what you're saying.
There's no tension there.
It's basically Republicans simply have a majority. They don't have a two-thirds majority.
So it was all
on the Democrats.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Paul Finkelman, who's helping me separate fact from fiction in the hit movie Lincoln. Stick around, because after the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and we'll talk some more with Paul Finkelman. Kelly Carmichael, welcome back to your weekly constitutional.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
Absolutely. So tell us now, what is the quiz question for this week?
Absolutely. Well, I have a good question for our fans of the law.
Fans of the law, legal type question.
Legal type questions. This is all up your alley, Stuart.
Okay.
All right, the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution permits the national and state governments to take property for public use if the owner is paid just compensation. This governmental power is known as A, eminent domain, B, private domain, C, government domain, or D, public domain.
Well, it's a safe bet that it's called something with the word domain in it.
Domain is it, yes.
Okay, but that won't get us the answer. We're looking for the name, the legal name, the legal concept that's reflected in the fact that the Fifth Amendment says the government can take our property, but it has to do so for a public purpose, and it has to pay us for doing so. All right, let's see what our contestant has to say about that. On the line, we have our contestant, Melanie. Melanie, where are you from?
Venus, Texas.
Venus, Texas. There's got to be a story there.
It's a small town just south of Dallas-Fort Worth area.
And you have no reason why it's named Venus?
Not that I've ever heard.
Is it a place just filled with love?
No, not really. It's just a small farm town.
Oh, I think Venus has something to do with love. I need to look in my Greek mythology. All right. Well, be that as it may, the question, of course, again, is what do we call it when the government takes your property? And let's go through the answer choices one by one. The first choice is A, eminent domain. Do you like that answer?
Yeah, I think that's the best choice.
Oh, really? Already out of the box. Well, hold on. Let's just go through the other ones and make sure you don't like those. How about B, private domain? That's not a good one?
I've actually never heard of that one.
Okay, that sounds like it's made up then. Okay, what about C, government domain?
Government domain to me would be government property that they already own.
Well, again, it seems reasonable. What about D, public domain? I've heard that one before. What about public domain?
I've heard it, but I've never heard it in conjunction with a taking.
Never heard
property.
It. Well, you sound very authoritative. Never heard about it in conjunction with a taking. So you're going to stick with A, eminent domain?
Yes, sir.
Then let's see if you're correct. So, Kelly, what's the answer to this legal type question?
The answer is A, eminent domain.
That is wonderful news, Melanie. Congratulations. You win a T-shirt.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Are you going to wear it with pride?
I most certainly will.
Tremendous. Thank you very much for playing.
Thank you.
Shall we stop this bleeding? Abolishing slavery settles the fate for millions now in bondage and unborn millions to come.
It's either the amendment or this Confederate peace. You cannot have both.
No one's loved as much as you by the people. Don't waste that power.
How many hundreds of thousands have died during your administration?
We must cure ourselves of slavery. This amendment is that cure.
God help us, for trapping you in a marriage that's only ever given you grief.
The fate of human dignity is in our hands. Blood's been spilled to afford us this moment. Now, now, now.
Never trusted the president, never trusted anyone.
The war will be over in a month.
Tell Lincoln to deny the rumors.
We are guaranteed to lose the whole thing.
Leave the Constitution alone.
You insult God.
You think they'll keep their promise?
I am the President of the United States of America, clothed in immense power.
And that, in case you didn't recognize it, was one of the trailers from the movie Lincoln. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Paul Finkelman of Albany Law School about separating fact from fiction in the hit movie Lincoln. Now, we were just discussing a couple of differences between what actually happened, what was in the movie, and that led me to another question. I wonder why, when you've got such a wonderful factual story, if you're a screenwriter, why would you ever change anything?
I'm just curious. Why do you think they would have done that then? Why would you think a screenwriter like, what's his name, Tony Kushner, would do that?
You know, I do not presume to know.
Because, I mean, there's enough dramatic tension, isn't there, if you just got the two parties?
I do not presume to know why people who make movies do what they do. But as I always tell my students, my friends, people who interview me like mm-hmm. you should understand that the purpose of a movie is to sell tickets.
Oh, sure.
The purpose of a movie is to entertain. And Steven Spielberg has no obligation to be historically accurate. That he may be historically accurate in general is done because it will help sell tickets. After all, if he had done something completely absurd, he would have been so pillared nobody would go to the movie. So there's a certain level of historical accuracy. Within that, there is a great deal of leeway. These movies usually have a historian consultant who the film people, from what my friends tell me who have been historian consultants, they're not listened to very much. They're kind of around there.
They just want the name and the credits, I suppose.
Yeah.
The thing is, I just don't see the dramatic necessity.
Here's the dramatic.
You've already got conflict.
Here's the dramatic necessity. If it is simply a debate between the Democrats and the Republicans, then it's kind of like politics as usual. There's no tension. There's no really dramatic tension. It's simply, how do I get a handful of Democrats to join us and pass this amendment?
Interesting.
In addition to that, the movie failed. The thing I think the movie failed most to understand is that the dramatic tension is wrong in another way. Republicans have a sweeping victory in 64. Republicans are the party of anti-slavery. This is the party that's going to end slavery. They are all running on they're running on the Emancipation Proclamation. They are running on ending slavery.
Well, so you think there was a mandate in the 64 election for emancipation?
Remember, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, a preliminary proclamation in September, final proclamation January 1st, 1863.
Right.
A year and 4 days ago today, as we do that.
Right.
150 years ago plus 4 days.
Right.
From the time of this interview. In 64, the Republicans are running on the Emancipation Proclamation.
Okay, they completely left that out. Because, right, in fact, they portrayed exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
They said people voted the Republicans in to end the war, and if we end the war, then all of that emancipation fervor will go away. And they even had that scene with that couple, I think, from Missouri.
Yeah, all right. Okay, so who runs against Lincoln in 1864? George B. McClellan, the mm-hmm. former general. George B. McClellan is running on a peace ticket. George B. McClellan says, if you elect me, I will end the war tomorrow. We will have peace tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens? McClellan gets clobbered everywhere in the North. And the biggest clobbering comes because it's the first time in U.S. history you have absentee voting from soldiers in the field. The soldier vote is overwhelmingly for Lincoln. I saw a letter. I did a Civil War roundtable in Cleveland. The Civil War roundtables are these organizations that have speakers, and they mm-hmm. To have some really good times. I love doing Civil War roundtables. It's just a lot of fun because you're working with people who are knowledgeable and interested and want to learn more. So I did a Civil War roundtable in Cleveland, and the next day I was driving somewhere, and the guy from the roundtable happened to be going up where I was going up, so he drove me up there. and he brought a big book where he had in the book all of the letters of his ancestors from the war. He had a great-great-great-grandfather, whatever, fought in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at the letters as we're driving. We're going from Cleveland to Detroit, so it's a long drive. I'm looking at the letters from the fall of 1864. And in one of the letters, he writes back to his wife saying, I would rather vote for Jefferson Davis than George McClellan, because at least Jefferson Davis is an honest traitor. Okay, now... This is the soldier vote. So the 64 election is about peace now, and the peace now people get beaten by the people who say, we will fight this war to its conclusion, which means destroying the Confederacy and ending slavery. Now, who's McClellan's running mate? Film never tells us. It's George Pendleton of Ohio. Thaddeus Stevens is...
great nemesis.
Yes, right.
So you're saying he'd already been repudiated at the polls.
He was a lame duck congressman. He's not reelected. I should have looked it up. I don't know whether he tried to run for Congress at the same time he was running for vice president.
Right.
Well,
this is disappointing, Paul, because that means that the central conceit of the movie, the central idea that we've got to get this done now because peace will undermine emancipation, that simply didn't exist. That's a complete invention.
Okay.
And that's unfortunate, because that really goes to the core of the whole dramatic arc of the film.
That's right. So the election takes place. Republicans have been swept in office. They're not going to take office, remember, for 13 months under normal circumstances.
Right.
Lincoln sends a message to Congress, and this is what Spielberg didn't put in the movie. And in this message to Congress, Lincoln says, we all know the next Congress will ratify the 13th Amendment. Isn't it better to do it now than wait? Isn't it better to do it sooner than later? Because we all know what the outcome will be. The outcome is not in doubt. Furthermore, we all know, because it's quite clear, that Lincoln will be inaugurated president on March 4th. And on March 5th, he will call a special session of Congress. And all of these new Republicans, plus the leftover Democrats,
mm-hmm.
will have to come back to Washington and have a emergency meeting of Congress so they can pass the 13th Amendment. And so one of the reasons why some Democrats either vote for the 13th Amendment or don't show up, which is the same thing as not voting against it, is because they don't want to be recalled for a special session in March.
Right.
They want to go home at the end of January and not have to come back for a while.
Wow. Okay, well, then so other than just the general desire to effectuate emancipation, and sooner being better than later, there was really not that issue of timing.
And no one believes the war is ending anytime soon.
Okay, well, that's unfortunate, because this reminds me then of the sorts of things that happens during reality shows. They create these false deadlines to create dramatic tension, and that seems to be the great sin that was committed in the movie then, is creating that false sense of urgency. We've got to do this now, otherwise we're not going to be able to do it.
Yes.
That's unfortunate.
And the other thing is the famous meeting at Hampton Roads with the Confederate delegates.
That's going to be the next question I had for you. How realistic was all of that, that there were these peace feelers coming
from
the
South? There were peace feelers. There was a meeting at Hampton Roads,
mm-hmm.
and at Hampton Roads, the Confederates said, you know, if you withdraw the Emancipation Proclamation, we could end this tomorrow and we'll come back into the Union. And Grant says no. Not even Lincoln. Grant, General Grant, who his men are dying, he says no. We haven't gone this far to stop now. And that's the feeling of the United States Army. That's the feeling of the officer.
Does he even consult with Lincoln on that?
Well, Lincoln's there. Lincoln's kind of nuts.
Okay.
But
it was Grant who spoke.
Grant responds before Lincoln can. Lincoln kind of, well, you know, I don't know. You know, Grant says, no, we're not doing that.
Right.
So the army is the great army of emancipation. That's how you have to think of the American army. When you're... when you're stuck in the middle of the night and you can't get anything on TV except Gone with the Wind, and you have to watch the nonsense of Tara being destroyed and Scarlett O'Hara losing her plantation and her life style, her lifestyle as she knows it.
Right.
And Sherman marching from Atlanta to the sea. You should understand that Sherman's march from Atlanta to Charleston is the greatest liberation of human beings in the history of the world until the Allies march on Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
Sherman liberates hundreds of thousands of slaves. Had he had the manpower, he could have sent the army further deeply into Georgia, further into Florida, and liberated more slaves, but hundreds of thousands of people.
Paul, you're defending General Sherman. You're going to get hate mail. You're going to get hate mail.
It'll happen. The fact is, General Sherman understands what the war is all about. He understands that it is about destroying the ability of the Confederacy to fight the war.
Total war.
Well, it's not total war the way it's fought today. He doesn't, for instance, line up civilians and shoot them.
No, I'm not talking about atrocities. I'm simply saying you're destroying the economy of your opponent. You're not just simply going into the field and fighting battles again and fix set pieces. You're trying to destroy the war-making capacity.
And by the way, the Confederates are doing the same things.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, when the Confederates vacate Columbia, South Carolina, which is the capital of South Carolina, they torch South Carolina, Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And they torch South Carolina's capital because they don't want military supplies to fall into the hands of the U.S. Army. They take what they can take, and what they don't have time to take, they burn.
Right.
There's in other words, it's scorched earth on the Confederate side. And it's total war on the United States side. But that's what's going on. So the army is not going to cave on emancipation any more than Lincoln is going to cave. And so...
In fact, by that time, hadn't Sherman promised or made supposedly his famous promise, 40 acres and a mule?
That was actually later.
Okay. But that was the attitude of the conquering armies, was that we're not coming down here just to go back to the status quo.
I would use the term liberating armies, not conquering armies.
Understood.
That they are liberating...
The victorious armies,
They are liberating 3 million slaves from bondage. They are not conquering anything, because remember... The purpose of the war is not to conquer the Southern population. The purpose of the war is to bring the South back into the United States as partners, as members of the nation. And then the purpose of the war becomes to liberate the millions of people who are held in bondage. And it is a liberating army.
And so by this time, those two causes, Union and emancipation, were inextricably bound together.
They are inextricably bound together. Okay. They are one and the same. That is what's going on. Now, Thaddeus Stevens, who is...
I want to hear about Thaddeus Stevens. How accurate was that Tommy Lee Jones portrayal?
Well, Tommy Lee Jones should get the Academy Award for this portrayal.
Okay, all you Academy members that were listening.
Although, it's a close call for the second point in the Hobbit movie, I suppose. because they're both great portrayals.
Uh-huh.
But Thaddeus Stevens is a brilliant lawyer. He is smart. He is acerbic. He is sarcastic. You don't want to be on Thaddeus's bad side.
Mm-hmm.
He is one tough guy.
You are smiling as you say this. You obviously like Thaddeus.
He is what my kids would call a badass. And apparently my kids tell me that's a high praise. Okay? Hope I can use that on the radio.
Sure.
Thaddeus Stevens has a club foot. Mm-hmm. He's born with a deformity. Thaddeus Stevens has a black housekeeper who everyone assumes is his mistress.
Wanted to ask you that dramatic scene where all of a sudden he's in bed with his black housekeeper.
And he's taken off his toupee and he's bald.
Right.
And he wore a toupee and everybody made fun of his toupee. Because one of the things that Spielberg gets wrong is that the toupee looks really good on Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, not as good on Thaddeus. That was accurate.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Very dramatic scene where he walks into the house and they end up in bed together. That was very, at least as far as we know.
And Thaddeus Stevens is buried buried next to his housekeeper in the black part of a segregated cemetery in Pennsylvania.
Well, that certainly...
Or a cemetery where the blacks were segregated from the whites.
Right.
And Thaddeus Stevens is the real deal. He is brilliant. He is acerbic.
Did he compromise the way it was portrayed in the film?
But
did he sort of back off politically, and was it that big a deal for him?
Again, I have not had time to go read the Congressional Globe, which was the predecessor of the Congressional Record, mm-hmm. to see what Stevens said, if in fact that debate existed.
Right.
But certainly... that catches the tenor of the Democrats. What the scene with Pendleton is trying to do is Pendleton, of course, is disgraced, defeated peace candidate or vice president. He represents the hardcore racist wing of the Northern Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
He represents Southern Ohio, which is very Southern.
Mm-hmm.
Although he's lost, he's no longer... there, he'll come back later on in another, and in the 1870s he'll have a political resurrection. But right now he's gone.
Right.
What he wants to do is to make the Republicans look bad by forcing them to admit that emancipation is for racial equality. Now, part of this is because of this tension that the Western Republicans won't vote for equality, that they'll vote for emancipation. That's not entirely true. After all, the Western Republicans include the Northern Republicans from Ohio. Remember, that's the West.
Mm-hmm.
They're some of the most radical Republicans in Congress. 13th Amendment was written by Lyman Trumbull, who is a Western Republican from Illinois. This U.S. Senator.
So there was not as much concern about social and political equality as the movie suggested then? I mean, certainly there were people who felt that way.
There are certainly plenty of people in the North who do not want social equality for blacks. There are some Republicans who don't want social equality for blacks. There are some Republicans who would rather not have it and really don't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what's being debated. What's being debated is the end of slavery.
We here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
We can't tell our people they can vote yes on abolishing slavery unless at the same time we can tell them that you're seeking a negotiated peace.
It's either the amendment or this Confederate peace. You cannot have both.
How many hundreds of thousands have died during your administration?
Congress must never declare equal those whom God created unequal.
Leave the Constitution alone.
We're stepped out upon the world stage now with the fate of human dignity in our hands. Blood's been spilled to afford us this moment. Now, now, now.
Abraham Lincoln has asked us to work with him to accomplish the death of slavery.
No one's ever been loved so much by the people. Don't waste that power.
This fight is for the United States of America.
Think we choose to be born, or are we fitted to the times we're born into?
Well, I don't know about myself. You may be.
Settles the fate for all coming time, not only of the millions now in bondage, but of unborn millions to come.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm trying to separate fact from fiction in the hit movie by Steven Spielberg, Lincoln. Paul Finkelman's helping me to do that, and right now we're talking about the difference between political equality and slavery on the one side and social equality on the other side. Are they exactly the same thing? Not exactly. Stick around. We'll talk about the differences.
So, Kelly Carmichael, what's happening this week at Montpelier?
Great question. This week at Montpelier, on Monday, February 18th, we will have our Enslaved Community Tour, which is a journey through the lives of more than 200 enslaved individuals during the Madison period. And it's a chance to visit the villages where they lived, the cellars and fields where they worked, and the cemetery where they now rest. So it's a, you know, an interesting conversation that we continue to have at Montpelier, where James Madison, the father of the Constitution, still had 200 enslaved individuals when he was there. So there's, you know, that discrepancy between, you know, are we the people versus who wasn't considered we the people at that particular time.
Right. An extremely important tour, an extremely important subject. And I must say that this is one of the times I'm proudest of Montpelier. I'm proud of all historic sites in the United States that don't shy away from our original constitutional sin. And that is, I mean, slavery is the great contradiction in our constitutional history. And Montpelier, it is front and center.
Indeed.
I mean, yeah, you walk there, and as you look at the mansion, you look just to the right of it, and you will see the outlines of the main slave community, the house slave community. And you'll go there, and the tour guides will tell you all about it. And there are a number of markers. There's the Gilmore Cabin, of course. There is the railroad station, the Jim Crow era railroad station. It's all right there, and nobody's hiding it. Everyone's talking about it very openly. So thank you very much for telling us about that.
Thank you, Stuart.
All right.
The accumulation of rights in the British system of government must have seemed like a process that was partly organic and partly a matter of happenstance, like the accretion of so many barnacles encrusting the ship of state over the years. The foundations and original reasons for many of Britain's common law rights have been lost in the mists of time, and some of its most esteemed charters of rights, such as the Magna Carta, were literally wrested from the king by force. The American constitutional process, eventually including the adoption of the Bill of Rights, was different. It was a process of reflection and choice, according to Alexander Hamilton, who wrote the Federalist Papers with John Jay and James Madison. During the framing and ratifying periods, Americans deliberately selected the most cherished rights from the British tradition and made them their own. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Our episode this week is Lincoln, Fact or Fiction. We're trying to figure out how accurate, how historically accurate the movie is. And it seems that one thing the movie did get right, at least generally speaking, is that the people at the time, the people who were debating the 13th Amendment, felt that there was a very big difference between freeing slaves on the one hand and political and especially social equality on the other.
And some Republicans believe that if you end slavery, social equality will have to come. But really, the issue is not social equality at all. It's political equality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big question. It's not...
We're going to free them, but are they going to be able to vote?
Are they going to be able to vote? Are they going to be able to have contracts? Will they be able to own property? Mm-hmm. Will they be able to be lawyers and doctors and full citizens? Not whether they will have what they call social equality.
Mm-hmm.
Lincoln himself has always been brilliant about evading this debate. In his debates with Douglas in 1858, Douglas accuses Lincoln of being in favor of interracial marriage and social equality. And Lincoln says that blacks are not my equal.
Now, was that his real opinion?
Don't cut me off there, please. No, because then you're missing.
Go ahead,
Lincoln
please.
Says, blacks are not my equal. They're not my equal in color. And he then goes on. And everybody says, yeah, that's right. They're not. And what does that mean? It means nothing. Of course, you know, he might also have said, by the way, they're not my equal in height. I'm over 6'4", and most of them aren't. You know, he could have said, Douglas is not my equal in height. So Lincoln, but then he goes on to say that in the right to keep what they earn with their own hands, to keep what they earn from their own labor, they are my equal and their Douglas is equal. And then he turns to Douglas, who's accused him of being in favor of interracial marriage, which is the big horror of the time. And he says, I'm nearly 50 years old, and I've managed to live my entire life with ever having a Negro as a slave or a wife. And I believe I can do that for the rest of my life. And then he turns to Douglas, who's, by the way, like 5 foot two, you know.
Right.
I think he kind of pats him on the head. And he says, but since Judge Douglas, he'd been a state Supreme Court judge, so he calls him Judge. Since it's Judge Douglas is so worried that he'll marry a black woman, I'll still be in favor of laws that prevent him from doing so. So that's the kind of thing. That's where right. the Republicans are at. So, no, there isn't this tension over equality. But the speech that Tommy Lee Jones makes, where he says, Pendleton thinks I'm in favor of equality. How could I believe there are equality when there are people, reptiles like you? That is vintage.
Stevens.
That is vintage Thaddeus Stevens, yeah.
Right.
The scene where the Democrat who thinks he ought to be elected to Congress, but the election is in dispute, and he goes to Stevens and he says, if you will support me as having my seat in Pennsylvania, I will become a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen says, who are you? I think I know who you are. You're this disgusting Democrat, and you're here to grovel for me. You know, he humiliates the guy and says, you'll become a Republican after you vote for the Emancipation.
When I say so.
Yeah, when I say so. That's Stevens is perfect.
Well, before we leave this, and I realize you've got someplace you've got to be, but what people are going to be most curious about is how accurate is the portrayal of Lincoln?
You know, how accurate can you portray somebody who is enormously complicated, has surely his own personal demons to deal with. He has had children die, as did most people. Most children, most families who have a number of children, some of the children die.
Mm-hmm.
Childhood death is common.
Right.
He has a wife who is surely, today she would be undoubtedly clinically depressed.
Right.
In those days, they say she's mentally ill or she's insane. Today, maybe the whole Lincoln family would be on Prozac and they would be better off. I think it portrays some of that. He has an enormously difficult job. He is facing circumstances that no other American leader has ever faced. And I think it conveys that very, very well.
One of the things I noticed is that it seemed to capture that sense of exhaustion that you see in so many Lincoln photographs.
Yes.
I mean, whenever you saw Daniel Day-Lewis, I mean, even when he was functioning well, he always seemed like he was carrying this terrible burden of fatigue and depression.
He's probably never getting a good night's sleep. Probably didn't get a good night's sleep for 4 years. I mean, if you look at President Obama,
mm-hmm.
he looks like he's aged far more than 4 years since he mm-hmm. became president.
Yeah.
If you look at anyone who has been president, the one exception I think is George W. Bush, who didn't seem to age at all in the White House. But if you look at other presidents, you look at John Kennedy when he's elected and in the months before he's murdered. It's a trying job today. You can only imagine what it was like for Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, he's tired, he's exhausted, he's worn out. He feels the incredible sorrow. At the beginning of the war, he wants to know the names of everybody who's dying in battle.
Right.
By the end of the war, he can't even face the numbers. It's no one expects this.
Right.
No one believes this will happen.
One aspect of Lincoln I'd always heard about was that he had a tenor voice. It was a high-pitched voice.
He's got a high-pitched voice, yes.
Which was unusual. You know, we always see these representations of him in this very deep, gravelly yeah. voice, all the rest of it. I think they did that pretty accurately.
Yeah.
I mean, as best I can tell, the Southern Midwestern twang.
Lincoln was born in Kentucky.
Yeah.
He was raised in deep South Indiana.
Right.
And he moved to Springfield, which is south of Richmond, Virginia.
Right.
If you just draw a line across the map.
Right.
So he has a southern accent, a twang, and a high-pitched voice.
And I thought that was very effectively represented. Okay, well, I've been asking you questions. Any final thoughts about Lincoln the movie or about historical fiction generally?
Well, I think that if the movie can get people to go and think about Lincoln and then go read some of the many very good biographies of Lincoln.
Which one you'd recommend for a good general introductory biography for someone who sees the movie and says, I'd like to know what really happened. I'd like to know something about Abraham Lincoln.
There is a older biography by a man named Stephen Oates.
Stephen Oates?
O-A-T-E-S. Okay. Called With Malice Toward None. That is a very good biography. Eric Foner won the Pulitzer Prize for his book about Lincoln and Emancipation last year. That would be a very good book to read, Our Fiery Trial. There are a number of very good historians who have written very good books about Lincoln.
Yeah, the problem with Lincoln is where do you begin?
But I would say, you know, get away from Carl Sandburg and the old-fashioned biographies and read some of the more modern ones.
Okay, and
James Oakes, mm-hmm. who teaches at City University in New York, has just written a book on Lincoln and Emancipation. That's a very good book. I would recommend that. Oakes also wrote a book called The Republican and the Radical, which is a kind of a joint study of Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. That's wonderful.
That sounds interesting. We've been very generous with other offers. What's the one publication of yours you'd recommend people read? Because I know you've written about a lot of things.
Well, I have not written a book about Lincoln. Mm-hmm. I've written about Lincoln in a couple of articles, mm-hmm. Including one in Supreme Court Review in 2008, which for the lawyers out there, they would know where to find that.
Right.
My most recent biography was of Millard Fillmore in the Times Books series, The American Presidents.
Right.
And I suppose reading the Fillmore biography would be a nice contrast to Lincoln, because in many ways Lincoln and Fillmore are very similar. They're both poor. They both grow up with almost nothing. They both have to scramble to get to where they are. They're both in Congress at the same time, and Lincoln is one term in Congress, is there with Fillmore as a Whig. Mm-hmm. And Fillmore ends up to be a completely catastrophic, failed, horrible president. And in the end, is one of the very few Whigs who doesn't follow Lincoln into the Republican Party. And at the end of the war is close to being a copperhead. It's very, very tragic.
You are the first person, Paul, to ever incite any interest in me and Millard Fillmore. We'll have to have you back on, and you'll tell us all about his failed presidency sometime.
Well, failed leadership is as important as successful leadership.
Indeed it is. Well, Paul Finkelman of the University of Albany Law School.
It's Albany Law. It's not the University.
Simply Albany Law
Albany
School.
Albany Law School, it is the oldest independent law school in the United States.
Tremendous.
And I am the President William McKinley Professor there because Major McKinley mustered out of the Ohio Volunteers at the end of the Civil War and went to the nearest law school to Northern Ohio, which was Albany Law School.
Well, isn't that fascinating? Thank you so much for being on the show. We appreciate you as always.
Thank you.
It's a great movie. I urge you to go see it. It may not be exactly historically accurate, but it's a darn good movie. And quite frankly, I'd have a hard time criticizing too strictly any movie that's all about the constitutional amendment process. Thanks very much to Paul Finkelman of Albany Law School for talking to us today about Lincoln, fact or fiction. Thanks also to our distribution engineers, Bob Hoffman, Larry Mayer, our scheduler, Carol Hutchinson. Of course, our executive producer is Wayne Winkler, and my name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are part of the American experiment.